The modern idea is you're supposed to accept yourself. I think that's an insane idea, by the way. Really, I can't think of a more nihilistic idea than that you're already okay. It's like, no, you're not. And the reason you're not is because you could be way more than you are. And so what do you want to be? You want to be okay as you are? Or do you want to strive towards what's better? Human beings are insufficient in and of themselves and need the movement upward. And so they need to conceptualize something like the highest good and then to strive for that.
You should love and feel good about the person you are now. And that's actually a dubious proposition for a variety of reasons. One is, whatever yourself is not only what you are. Yourself is also what you could become. And so to love yourself properly is not only to love what you are, who you are, whatever that means, but to love who you could become. Now, one of the things I've observed is that it's very demoralizing for the typical young person who's miserable and maladjusted psychologically and socially if you just go to them and say, well, you should feel good about yourself, because they think you're good just the way you are. You're perfect just the way you are. You should accept yourself just the way you are. It's like, well, okay, so what does that say about who I should become? Is that just now off the table because I'm already good enough in every way? So am I done or something? What about who I should become? And then, well, how should I feel good about myself when I don't? Because I'm not getting along with myself. I'm anxious and hopeless and nihilistic and depressed. And I'm not getting along with other people. So how is it that that's all somehow something I should feel good about without being deluded? And these are complicated questions because you don't want to beat yourself with a stick, which might be the opposite of that. So, well, feel bad about yourself. It's like, no, be judicious and merciful with yourself and think that you need to accept yourself in some way, the way a mother accepts a child. But the maternal spirit is not the only spirit that governs the love that a child requires properly. You have the paternal spirit of encouragement as well, which is, well, we need to shelter and protect you and to provide for your security the way you are, but you could be a lot better and should be. And I have faith that you could be, which is the love that I'm delivering to what you're becoming rather than what you are. And so love that you direct towards yourself is partly directed towards that maternal care that's sort of the minimum precondition for basic flourishing, combined with an attitude of encouragement towards the possibilities of your being. And so that's a much more sophisticated so-called self-love, partly because it's the kind of love that envisions you as something that unfolds across time. And it's a much richer conception because it also implies that there's a responsible adventure to your life. You're not all you could be, and there's pain in that. And there's the necessity for a certain amount of judgment about that, and even a certain amount of exclusion, because what you are that is insufficient in some sense should be not be allowed to propagate further. But if it's conjoined with encouragement, it's like, yeah, you're in a rough situation there, kiddo, but, you know, here's some things about you that are virtuous and good, and they're pretty powerful, actually, and if you just made those more manifest, you could dispense with a lot of this immaturity and misery, and you could expand yourself out into life physically and psychologically, and you could start walking this pathway that makes things better. And the thing is that as soon as you start walking the pathway that makes things better, then things immediately become better because your whole orientation changes. And, you know, if you're in a bad place but you're escaping, that's pretty positive, even if it's a bad place. And you might think, well, it's still bad, but it's better. It's like, well, that's a lot better than a bad place that's getting worse. That's for sure, because that's hell. Hell is a bad place that's getting worse. That's for sure. And so if you take the bad place and it's getting better, well, it's already not hell. That's a start. And so this notion of love, we've confused this with the maternal instinct for an infant. It's like, because an infant under 6 months, it's like, well, of course, your attitude towards an infant is you're exactly okay the way you are. But that's not what you do to any child that's older than 6 months. You start laying down some criteria for becoming, for improvement. And some of that improvement, because we can define it, well, there's nothing more perfect than a child, than a baby. It's like, yeah, but that's not true if the baby's 14 years old. right? It's true if the baby's 6 months old and actually a baby, but by 9 months, well, the child is going to be start to interact socially. And now there's some principles that the child has to learn to abide by so that social interaction is optimized. You want to take the infant who's entirely dependent and turn them into something that's autonomous and then socially integrated, and then socially integrated in a manner that's moving them towards individual responsibility. And the love is not only love that's devoted to what they are at any point, which is that encompassing maternal love, say, but the love that says, yeah, kid, you know, we're pretty happy you're around, but the new you is going to even be better. And that's encouragement, and that's part of love. It's half of love, that's for sure. And you want to direct that to yourself as well. It's like, you don't want to judge who you are so harshly that you just destroy yourself and everything is cast into the pit. You want to take a look at yourself and say, look, you know, you're a person among persons and you have intrinsic worth and you have your flaws, your sins, your domain of ignorance and inadequacy, but that doesn't mean that you're entirely worthless because of that. You have a base level value. That's intrinsic worth, let's say, that's reflective of the fact that you're made in the divine image. In the most fundamental sense, you have intrinsic worth, and that's due a certain degree of baseline love. But there's the becoming problem. It's like, well, especially when you're young, most of you is still in the becoming phase. And so why wouldn't encouragement be the hallmark of love? It's like, get the hell up, get your act together, adopt some responsibility, put your life together, develop a vision, expand yourself beyond the narrow confines that are causing your misery. And we think you can do it. You could do it. You should do it. The world would be better off if you did it. You'd be doing better if you did it. Everything would work out better. Why would we not work to make everything work out better? And you're the person who could do it. And you tell young people that and they think, well, no one ever told me that before in that way. And they think, well, maybe I should get my act together. And then they go out and try to get their act together. And they think, well, huh, turned out that worked and I'm less miserable. I could try doing it a little bit on a broader scale. And they try that and they think, wow, people seem a lot happier with me. I have more friends and I'm more popular and I'm a little more physically attractive because I'm standing up a little bit straighter. And then away they go and unfold, man. Be a force for good in the world. And that'll be the adventure of your life.
Aimless is not nothing. Aimless is bad. Nietzsche said if you had a why, you could bear any how.
Most people find the meaning in their life through responsibility. I believe the fundamental religious truth of the idea that life is suffering. It's suffering because we're mortal and fragile and because we're also subject to malevolence at our own hands and at the hands of others. It's a constant existential problem. And that can make you bitter and can make you hopeless and nihilistic and depressed and anxious and likely to abuse substances of various sorts as a medication or an escape. It can auger you in a very large number of ways. And I'm suggesting to people that there is a way out of that. And the way out is to confront that forthrightly and to adopt responsibility in your own life and to try to make the world a better place, and that it's necessary to do that. And that if you don't do that, that things go badly.
I think the deck is stacked against everyone to some degree because life is very difficult and we all die. So, but some people do have it harder than others. And all of us have it very hard at some times in our lives. It's like, well, what's the alternative? You take responsibility for that and try to struggle uphill because the alternative makes everything worse.
Find something in your life that's so worthwhile doing that the fact that you're going to suffer is justifiable.
Yeah, life's rough, no doubt about it. And if good luck comes your way, then you should be grateful for it. And if happiness manages to manifest itself, you should be grateful for that too.
So then you might ask yourself, well, what's the best antidote to the discomfort of life? And you might say, well, it's comfort. And I suppose that's what you act out when you swaddle a baby. But a better antidote is something like adventure to excellence. And that's far better antidote to suffering than the mere absence of suffering. So not to say that the mere absence of suffering, that's not nothing.
I've been a psychotherapist for 20 years. I've seen things you can't imagine, horror shows that you can't fathom, and people who have been hurt in so many ways, so many dimensions. It's like, should they be bitter? Should they be resentful? Should they become violent? These things don't help. They have to struggle uphill despite their excess burden. And it's responsibility, not guilt.
It's the female crucifixion.
That's
so, and that's exemplified best in, well, the best portrayal of that I've seen is Michelangelo's Pieta. You know, it's a statue of Mary, and she has Christ's body on her, as an adult, on her lap, and yep. he's broken and destroyed, and, you know, she's displaying that. And that's the bravery of a mother to allow that to happen, but not only that, to facilitate it. Facilitate it. Way you go, kid. Way you go. Way you go. Well, why? It's dangerous out there. It's like, yeah, no kidding. It's more dangerous here if you stay with me by a lot. So you might lose your body out there in the world, but if you stay here, you lose your soul.
You know, I mean, it's a pretty competitive world. There's lots of competition for young men in particular. There's competition for status and limited resources and for the attention of women. And just because you're nice doesn't necessarily mean that you come out particularly well in those competitions.
I would like to say that you should all be smarter, but I don't know how you could be smarter. We don't know anything about how to improve intelligence, and I suppose we don't really know anything about how to improve industriousness either, but I can tell you that people who are industrious come up with a strategy for solving the problem that's ahead of them, and then they do whatever they can to stick to the strategy. And so, for example, if you sat down today or tomorrow for a couple of hours, 3 hours, and you filled in a Google Calendar, whatever you happen to use, with a strategy for studying and a list of when all your assignments are due and all of that, and when you're going to sit down and study, then you won't be in a position where you have to cram for 10 hours a day hopelessly right before, you know, an important exam.
It's beautifully put that love is the highest ideal to reach for, and truth is...
It's handmaiden. I thought about that for a long time, right? This hierarchy of ideal. And the thing about truth, that bitter truth, let's say, that cynical truth, is it can break the shackles of naivety. And actually, a burnt cynicism is a moral improvement over a blind naivety, even though one is in some ways positive, but only because it's protected, and the other is bitter and dark, but still better. But you're not done at that point. You're just barely started.
I think optimally we exist to have something like a playful adventure, right? We're built for an optimal challenge. It's partly why we like to play. In play, you find an optimal challenge. It's almost like the definition of play. And so, if you can organize yourself and the world optimally, then you have adventure. And maybe you have the adventure of your life. And if you can do that brilliantly, then you can do it in a spirit of play. That's what you need and want.
I saw an endless repetition in my clinical practice and in my own private life when my eyes were open, the consequences of not saying what was true. It's like whatever hell you might fall into by opening your mouth when you have something to say that isn't popular, it's nothing like the hell that you're going to envelop yourself in if you lose control of your own tongue and mind. And I, like I said, in my clinical practice, I never saw anyone get away with anything even once. And so all you have in a situation like that is what is the truth. Now, you know, of course, you only have your approximations to the truth, but that's better than nothing. And so you need to be afraid of the right thing, and you should be afraid of contaminating your soul with deceit. That's what you should be afraid of. What happens is, you know, garbage in, garbage out, the old programmer saying goes, and so you'll fill your head with nonsense and no one will call you on it except you, but you can still that voice if you try hard enough. You just wait until you get in real trouble. You know, one day there'll come a point where you have to make a decision, and the decision is the difference between life and death, or worse, between someone else's life and death, or worse, between health and the suffering that's worse than death. And because you've compromised yourself to such a degree, you will not be able to rely on your judgment, and you will make the mistake you shouldn't make.
and then you're done. And that will absolutely happen.
Yeah, well, I mean, you set what's great against what's tragic.
Yeah.
I mean, what else could you possibly do? And so then you say, well, how do you find what's great in your own life? And part of that is you watch. It's like, when is it that I'm doing something that alleviates my suffering, right? It's real. You have to ask that question to yourself honestly. One of the things you have them do is say, well, why don't you just watch for a week? Like, watch yourself like you don't know who you are and just see when you're not quite as miserable.
Yeah.
And then let's see if we can figure out what it is about what you're doing in that situation that's lifting the gloom. It's like, okay, there's something in that that's curative, right? And that's something in that that's curative is related to, well, you might say your purpose. It's like maybe part of the reason you're depressed is because you're too isolated. Well, now we can work on that. So let's see if we can increase the amount of time you're spending with your friends by like 20%. Or maybe you need a couple of new friends. Or maybe you need to work on your comic material, you know, because you can set that against the tragedy of life.
I've been trying to figure out what gives people's lives meaning. And if you look at it technically, in order to have any positive meaning in your life, you have to have identified a goal and you have to be working towards it. And there is a technical reason for that. And the technical reason, as far as I can tell, is that the circuitry that produces the kind of positive emotion that people really like is only activated when you're proceeding towards a goal that you value. And so that means that if you don't have a goal that you value, you can't have any positive emotions. So technically that's the incentive reward system, and it's the underlying circuitry is dopaminergic. And when that circuitry is activated, then it's part of the exploratory circuit. It gives you the sense of being actively engaged in something worthwhile. You know, you tend to think of positive emotion as something produced by reward. But there's two kinds of positive emotion. One is the reward that's associated with satiation, and that's consummatory reward, and that's the reward you get when you're hungry and you eat. But the thing about eating when you're hungry is that it destroys the framework within which you were operating, right? It's time to eat. Well, you eat, and then that framework's no longer relevant. So the consummatory reward eliminates the value framework, and then you're stuck with, well, what are you going to do next? And so the consummatory reward has with it its own problems, but the incentive reward is constantly what keeps you moving forward. And incentive reward, because it's dopaminergic, also is analgesic, literally analgesic. So if you're in pain, you take opiates and that will cut the pain, but so will psychomotor stimulants like cocaine or amphetamines. And so it's literally the case that if you're engaged in something that's engaging and you're working towards a goal, that you're going to feel less pain. And you can see this happening with athletes who, you know, they'll break their thumb or something, or maybe sometimes even their ankle, and they'll keep playing the game. Of course, afterwards, they're suffering like mad, but the fact that they're so filled with goal-directed enthusiasm means that, well, the pain systems are in some sense shut off. So that's an interesting thing, because what it suggests, I mean, then you could imagine, I might say, well, how happy are you that you've made a certain amount of progress? And if you think about it, what you'd say is, well, it depends on how much progress and in relationship to what. So hypothetically, you're going to be happier if you've made quite a bit of progress towards a really important goal. And then you have to think through what it means for a goal to be really important, because that's not obvious. Now, you could say, you're in this class and you're listening to some information, and maybe there's two reasons for that. You might find the information interesting per se, but let's forget about that for a minute. You need to listen to the information so that you can do well on the assignment, so that you can do well in the class. You need to do well in your classes so that you can finish up your degree. You need to finish up your degree so that you can find your place in the world. You need to do that so that you're financially stable and maybe you can start a family and have a life, and that's all part of being a good person, something like that. And so that's a hierarchy of goals, and you might say that being a good person would be the thing, however vaguely thought through, that's at the top of that hierarchy. And then when you're doing things that serve that ultimate purpose, then you're going to find those more meaningful, and that meaning is actually produced as a consequence of the engagement of this exploratory circuit that's nested right down in your hypothalamus. It's really, really old. It's as old as thirst, and it's as old as hunger. It's really an old system. And so you want to have that thing activated. It might be that the sense of meaning that life can provide to you is proportionate to the amount of responsibility you decide to take on. And that'd be very strange if it was the case, you know, because responsibility, of course, is a kind of weight, obviously, and it's difficult to take on responsibility. But if any positive emotion that you feel and your control of anxiety and the control over pain is dependent on the activation of these systems that watch you move towards a desired goal, then the more complete and weighty the goal is, the more kick there's going to be in the observation that you're moving towards it. And you know, you kind of already know this because you'll have observed in your own life that when you're engaged in something that you believe in, that the time passes properly. You know, you can see this even if you're maybe you're reading a paper and it's actually related in some intelligible manner to something that you want to learn. So even though it's difficult, you get engaged in it, you can remember it better, you can process it better, and you're not so likely to fall asleep, and you're not so likely to want to find distractions, all of that, you can get into it. And it would be very interesting if that was proportionate to the degree of responsibility that you're willing to shoulder, and I think you can make a strong case for that. I've also often wondered, imagine you could offer people a choice. Here's the choice. You could say, well, your life isn't meaningful. The nihilists have got it right. There's no meaning in your life. And because of that, there's no reason for you to accept any responsibility. So you can live a responsibility-free life, and maybe one of impulsive pleasure-seeking, but a responsibility-free life. But the price you pay is that it doesn't get to be meaningful. Or you could say to someone, no, we're going to do the opposite. We're going to say, you can live a meaningful life, but it's only going to be as meaningful as the amount of responsibility that you're willing to bear. And then you might say, well, what would people choose? Because everybody also always makes noises about wanting to have a meaningful life. But if the price you pay for that is the adoption of responsibility, then it's not so obvious that people would choose meaning over, you know, over pointless pursuits, if the benefit they got for choosing the pointless pursuits was that they really didn't have to care about anything they ever did, right? It's no responsibility. When you go from a bad place to a better place, you go to a worse place first. It's a great thing to know because it also tells you why you might be unwilling to take the next step. You know, you're aiming up, but in order to aim up, you have to let go of something you already have. And then that'll put you into a state of chaos. And unless you're willing to undergo that intermediary state of chaos, and you might not recover from it, you're not going to get to the next level. Many of you, I presume, have seen Breaking Bad. You have this ordinary high school teacher who really thinks that he's an axe, and his family as well. You know, like your typical persona, roughly speaking. He's just a normal guy. But part of the reason that he's a normal guy is because he actually hasn't been put in abnormal circumstances, and then all of a sudden he is. And he has a genuine moral conundrum, right? He's going to die of lung cancer, and he has a son who's got a lot of health problems, and he's terrified that he's going to leave his wife and his child behind with nothing. And so he decides to do something that temporarily that he regards as what they would normally regard as reprehensible. And of course, he just gets tangled up in that. But then as the story unfolds, you see that it's more complicated because it's not that he was just innocent, good guy and he decided to turn bad. He's also very resentful and angry. And it's partly because he's a bit of a pushover at the beginning, or maybe more than a bit of a pushover. And also that he didn't really fulfill his own potential, and that, you know, he had friends who walked down the entrepreneurial path, and maybe they weren't quite fair to him, but whatever, he ends up not very successful as a high school teacher. And so he's really angry about that. And so there's more motivation for him opening up the door to the terrible elements of his personality than just the fact that he's got good motivations to do so, and that unfolds, you know. And so you see the warps and twists in his resentful character increasingly manifest themselves as he walks down this road to really total brutality. So it's one step at a time, and that's the thing, is that you end up in very bad places one step at a time, so you've got to watch those steps. Sometimes you take a leap forward and you learn some things, but you can't catalyze a new identity, so you try to go back and hide in your old identity. And that actually doesn't work because, well, things have changed and you've learned something and that isn't who you are anymore. And so it's like you have to cut parts of yourself off in a destructive manner to fit back into the person that you were.
One of the times in your life when you actually realize that you're an individual is when you'll go and ask your parents something and you'll realize they actually don't know any more about what you should do than you do. And that sucks. And that's partly why people are often willing to maintain a tyrant-slave relationship with their father. It's like, on the one hand, you have to be inferior in a relationship like that. You know, you've always got the judge watching you. But on the other hand, there's always someone who knows what to do. There's always someone standing between you and the unknown that you can go ask, what should I do? Well, at some point, you'll realize that the reason you can't ask that anymore is because they actually don't know any more than you do. And then that's a pain, like that is a symbolic death. And that's also when you establish a more individual relationship with your parents. It's at that point that you could conceivably start taking care of them instead of the reverse. And that's a time that should come. But you have to let that image of perfection go, and that exposes you.
When you're doubtful, say you're trapped, you ask yourself, well, why am I trapped? And that's a hard question, right? Some of it's your own inadequacy. You ask yourself, you sit on the bed and say, okay, man, I'm ready to learn something. Like, what's one thing I'm doing wrong that I know I'm doing wrong that I could fix, that I would fix? It's like, you meditate on that, you'll get an answer. And it won't be one you want, but it'll be the necessary one. We kind of experience life as if we're tossed into it. You're male and not female. You're Hindu and not Christian. You're tall and not short. You have an arbitrary range of talents and an arbitrary range of limitations, none of which, in some sense, you chose. It's the cards you're dealt. Now, some of those are cards of privilege. Now, maybe you're born intelligent. Maybe you're born symmetrical. Maybe you're born healthy. Maybe you're born into a culture where it's much easier not to be absolutely deprived. And so, all of that, in some sense, is unearned. Now, the way you pay for your privilege is with your virtue. You have these opportunities and this existential guilt. And the way you expiate that and atone is by doing your best to live the best possible life you can manage, to speak the truth, to treat people with respect, to abide by the principles of the dignity of the individual, and to put your house in order. And that's how you pay for your unearned privilege. And we all have our privileges and our curses. All of us have that. That's why it's not useful to be envious of people. Carl Jung said, people in the modern world don't see God because they don't look low enough. And so imagine you're in your messy bedroom and you're sitting on the edge of the bed trying to have an honest dialogue with yourself. And the little voice says, you know, it's pretty disgusting in here. And you think, well, I'm way above such trivial niceties as organizing my room. Well, that's pride. If you're above organizing what's actually yours, how in the world are you ever going to organize anything else? Well, it's time to take a brush to the toilet, and maybe that's where you start. And that works. You start making those micro improvements, like real micro improvements, real on the ground, actual micro improvements to things you know that are wrong, you'll improve unbelievably rapidly. Just look at how much opportunity you have to make things better. Not that it's easy. We're built to walk uphill. And when you reach the pinnacle of the hill, you want to stop and appreciate the vision. But the next thing you want is a higher hill in the distance, because it's from the uphill climb that we derive our value. And I mean this technically. Almost all the positive emotion we feel, especially the emotion that fills us with enthusiasm, that's experienced in relationship to a goal. You want a goal that you can never attain, so you can always move closer to the goal that recedes as you move towards it. You think, well, that's frustrating. It's like Sisyphus pushing the rock uphill. But it's not, because as you pursue that goal, you put yourself together and your life does get better and richer and more abundant. You're here to live, not to sleep. The problem with the vision of Mai Tais on the beach is that, first of all, that's a vision of drug-induced unconsciousness. Second, it's only going to work for about a week. Third, you're going to be a laughingstock in a month and depressed and aimless. I think the right solution to the most serious problems is to be found at the level of the individual. Jung said, for example, that we all acted out a myth, and whether we knew it or not. And, you know, maybe you're acting out a tragedy. Maybe you're acting out Narcissus. You don't know, because you've put that on yourself in an attempt, in some ways, to deliver to people what they want, or more accurately, to look as though you're delivering to people what they want. Someone who's really infantile and dependent, someone who's never left home, part of their problem is that they haven't crafted a persona. So you don't want to denigrate it entirely, but it's no substitute for the real thing. And it turns out that not only is what we want from each other the real thing, but that's also the adventure of your life. If you aren't truthful, and that means, unfortunately, especially at the beginning, when you start to be truthful, it means deeply coming to terms with your inadequacies in humility. So it's very painful. Without that, you don't have the adventure of your life. You have the role that you've acquiesced to. In my clinical practice, in 20 years, working with every sort of person you could imagine, I never ever saw anyone get away with anything even once. We're all subject, not least, to the judgment of our own conscience. Try to escape from that. No one can escape from that. We have to contend with that wisely. And then you ask, well, how do you contend with things wisely? And I would say, well, don't pollute your thoughts with deceit. You compromise your own wisdom. How are you going to make intelligent, not intelligent decisions, wise decisions? That's why you shouldn't lie. You're warping the mechanism that orients you in the world. I think Pinocchio is brilliant work of art. And if you're a puppet and an actor, and Pinocchio is both at times in that movie, both a puppet and an actor. So why an actor? Like, why is there something wrong with being an actor? Well, the first question is, who sets your role? And then the second question is, who's pulling your strings? Because you have to act out your ideals to some degree, right? And you also have to formulate a avatar of yourself in some sense that's a mediator between you and other people. You need this functional shell. The problem arises when that functional shell is all that there is. And then the real person underneath is just desperate and unhappy because nothing of what's being acted out reflects a true underlying reality. You don't want someone else's fate. Man, your fate's enough. So you speak truthfully and you watch what happens. Will truth, beauty, and love save the world? Well, you can find out.
Don't overestimate yourself, but don't underestimate who you could be. That's a much better way of thinking about it. You know, psychologists of the careless sort, I would say, have been pushing the idea of self-esteem for a very long time, probably since the early 60s. You should be content with yourself the way you are. It's like, no, you shouldn't. Seriously, like, you're nowhere near what you could be. You're not even close. Right, and so that's a way more optimistic message. Like, it's, you ain't seen nothing yet. That's the right message. And so I would say, don't overestimate yourself now, but don't underestimate your future self. And you have so much influence as an individual, if you get your act together, that you can't believe it. There isn't anything that has more influence than that. You have all the power that there is right where you are to put things right around you. You start now, you develop a noble vision, right, of who you could be. You start to put that into practice, develop some discipline, familiarize yourself with the great works of the past. Learn to read, learn to write, learn to speak, learn to think. Man, you'll be deadly.
What you could bring to the table that hasn't been brought to the table for years is an emphasis on individual responsibility. And the right way to do that, as far as I'm concerned, is to start with yourselves, is develop a vision for your life. You start to think about, if you could be who you could be, what would that look like? That's the beginning of a mature philosophy of being. If you could be the person that you would admire, who would that person be? How would you configure yourself? How would you configure your career, your education, your family, your the use of time outside of work? If you wanted to be the noblest person that you could be, who was adopting the maximal amount of responsibility, how would that look? Then you need a strategy to put that into place. And that's the way you change things properly, and also the way you do the least amount of harm while you're changing them. And so it should be an individual focused set of ideas, and that way you can sidestep the identity politics traps, and that would be a very good thing. And I think a modern conservatism, which isn't really all that distinguishable from a classical liberalism as it turns out, is to put tremendous stress on the responsibility of the individual. And one of the things that's wonderful about that, as far as I'm concerned, and I made reference to this a few minutes ago, is that you need a meaning to offset the tragedy of life. Otherwise, you just suffer stupidly, and you tend to make people around you suffer the same way. The way that you find that meaning is by adopting as much responsibility as you can. And what's also so fascinating about that is, you know, you're characterized by an indefinite potential. And it isn't easy to understand exactly what that is, that potential, but you know, it's what people call you on when they say, you know, you're not living up to your potential, whatever that is. That potential will be called forth from you as a consequence of adoption of responsibility, because it won't manifest itself unless you take on a load. You're not going to develop in all the ways you could develop unless you set yourself a serious challenge, because it takes the challenge to pull that out of you, and also to motivate you to rid yourself of all the weaknesses and personality flaws that you've accumulated across the years, and to let those disappear and burn off you. You need to load yourself up before the demands of life will be such that you will discipline yourself properly. And a noble goal is a very good way of beginning that. The truth of the matter is, as far as I'm concerned, that each of us has enough potential character, power of character, let's say, if it's properly manifested, to contend with that in a noble way, and to rise above it, and to transcend and to deal with it in large part, because we can make the world a much better place than it is for each of us individually, and for our families, and for our community. And we can constrain the malevolence, at least in our own hearts, and perhaps have a positive effect on those around us as a consequence. And that actually does make things better, and we actually can do that. And that's where the meaning in life is to be found. And that meaning, you know, that goes along with the adoption of that kind of responsibility, is actually the antidote to the suffering. You know that perfectly well, because all of you need a reason to get out of bed in the morning, especially on a rough morning, you know, when things aren't going so well in your life. And there will be plenty of times when things aren't going so well in your life, and you still need a reason to get up and get moving and get out there. And if you have adopted the responsibility at an individual level to make things better, given how bad they are, if you've adopted the responsibility to make things better, then you have a reason to get up. And so one of the things that I've been stressing to people is that there's very little difference between the meaning in life that gives you fulfillment and that engages you in existence, and the willingness to shoulder as much individual responsibility as you can possibly handle. Those are the same things. And that's a really useful thing to know. And you kind of know this, right? Everybody knows this, because first of all, if you're not living up to your responsibilities, even to take care of yourself, the probability that you're going to be ashamed of that at some level is extraordinarily high. And so your own soul tells you that you're in error, so to speak. But also, if you look at who you spontaneously admire, which is a good indication of where your value system really sits, you'll see that the people you admire are always people who take responsibility for themselves, and responsibility for their family, and responsibility for their community. Get your act together. You've got things to do in the world. The absence of your full being in the world leaves a hole that is filled by terrible things. At minimum, you have an ethical responsibility to ensure that the world doesn't devolve into something approximating hell. And at maximum, you have the responsibility, again, the ethical, that is a heavy ethical responsibility, to do everything that's in your power to make things as good as you can possibly make them in this sophisticated manner that takes you and your family and your community into account. And it's on you, right? And that's meaning, you know. People say, well, I'd like to have a meaningful life. It's like, well, fair enough, but the price that you pay for the meaning that transcends tragedy is the adoption of responsibility for the catastrophe of existence. But that ennobles you, right? It makes you into someone strong and someone competent and someone who's worthwhile and who lives in a manner that justifies their own suffering. And that's what, there's nothing better than you could possibly do than that. Although there is a very large number of ways of looking at the world, or perhaps a near infinite number of ways of looking at the world, there isn't a near infinite number of ways of acting in the world in a manner that actually is successful. So, so there are constraints on how you can interact with the world in a successful manner. Let's assume that you don't want undue pain and anxiety. We could just start with that, and I think that's a reasonable proposition. You could tolerate some pain and anxiety if it's in the service of something greater, obviously, but I just mean pointless pain and anxiety. We don't want any more of that than is necessary. And that means that you have to take care of yourself to some degree. But the manner in which you take care of yourself is severely constrained. This is partly why you have to be intelligent and careful and plot your way through life properly. You have to take care of yourself today, but you have to take care of yourself today in a way that doesn't interfere with you taking care of yourself tomorrow and next week and next month and next year and 5 years from now and 10 years from now. So you can't do just what you want to in the next hour. Because if it's impulsive, pleasure-seeking, let's say, something like that, excess alcohol use or excess drug use or careless sexual behavior or betrayal of people to gain you something in the moment, you're going to pay for that. You're going to pay for it tomorrow. You're going to pay for it next week and next month and next year. So because you're going to exist in the future and because you have to live with yourself, there's only a certain number of ways that you can act that are going to work. But it's more than that. It's not just that you're responsible to your future self or the set of all your future selves, is that you also have to act in a way that works for your family, because otherwise your family is going to disintegrate and break down and cause you and them all sorts of misery and grief, and not just your family now, but also your family into the future, and then not just your family either, but also your community. And so you have to set your aspirations so that they serve you in the broadest sense over a long period of time, and they also serve your family and they also serve your community. And that's a very tight set of constraints. And I think that the best solution to that set of constraints from a philosophical perspective, or maybe even a theological perspective, is to view the world as a place not of groups, but of individuals, of sovereign individuals who are responsible for their destinies, responsible for their families and for their communities. You learn to use minimal necessary force. It's like you don't defend yourself any more than you have to. Like, be careful. Don't push any harder than you need to. Because all you do is you generate a counterforce by pushing harder than you need to. And then you're in conflict. And you think, well, I like a little conflict. It's like, look, fair enough, a little conflict, man, no problem. It keeps your life kind of interesting, and maybe that's on the problem-solving edge. But a little conflict can become a lot of conflict very, very rapidly, and if you have any sense at all, that's not what you want. You know, especially if you have other things that are better to do, and you should have other things that are better to do.
18-year-old kids. One sentence. What would you say to them? What's the restorative, the redemptive sentence? What should they do?
Don't be thinking your ambition is corrupt. You know, because that's part of the message now. Human beings, we're a cancer on the planet. We're headed for an environmental apocalypse. The entire historical structure is nothing but atrocity, etc., etc. Anyone with any ethical aim whatsoever is just going to pull back. You don't want to manifest any ambition, support the patriarchal structure, exploit the environment. You got to crush yourself down. You shouldn't even have any children. It's like, no, there's no excuse for that. There's zero excuse for that. I saw a professor at an event, something like this. He came out and trumpeted this bloody environmentally friendly house he'd built. And, you know, fair enough, man. It was a pretty interesting house. But not everybody had the $4 million that
it took him to build it. And I'm not criticizing his money even. It's like, he's had some money, good for him. He built a house, okay. But then to trumpet that as a moral virtue, well, you're pushing it there. And then he came out to all the kids and he said, you know, my wife and I decided that we were only going to have one child. And I think that's one of the most ethical things we could have possibly done. And I would strongly encourage you to do the same. I thought, you son of a b-. You get up in front of these young people. A lot of these kids were children of first-generation immigrants from China. And he showed all these images, you know, of these terrible factories in China, these endless rows of sterile mechanism that were subordinating all the Chinese people to this terrible, you know, capitalist machine. And I thought, you don't understand, half the audience is looking at those factories and thinking, that's a hell of a lot better than struggling through the mud under Mao, buddy. And so, I don't know where he thought he was, but to come out in front of all those kids and basically tell them that the whole human enterprise is so goddamn corrupt that the best thing they could possibly do is limit their multiplication, and to think of himself as a scholar and an educator. I did say something, by the way. It was rather uncomfortable, and he stomped off the stage. But that's no message for young people. There's no excuse for that. And you think, we're going to destroy the planet. We have to do this. We have to demoralize the youth to be ethical. It's like, yeah, really, that's your theory. You're going to demoralize young people to be ethical. That's your theory. It's like, you should go home and think about that for like a year. And I'm passionate about this, you know, because you have no idea how many people that's killing. You have no idea. I see people everywhere, all over the world, they're so demoralized, especially young people with a conscience, because they've been told since they were little that there's nothing to them but corruption and power. It's like, how the hell do you expect them to react? If you orient yourself ethically in the most fundamental sense, then in some sense you have the force of God on your side, and then maybe you can prevail despite the difficulty. And I think that's right. I think that's true. So, and you can ask yourself, I try to ask these questions seriously, you know, and I would also say that I've been driven to my religious belief, such as it is, by necessity, not by desire. What do you want to have on your side when you're contending with the unknowable future and its vagaries? How about truth? How about beauty? How about justice? You want allies? Those are powerful allies. People have to act as ethically as they are powerful. And so I've been trying to convince people to do that, I suppose, or to put forward, not to convince them precisely, but to put forward an argument about why that's necessary and why it's on them. It's like, no, this is on you. You got to understand this problem, it's you. You don't get it right, it isn't going to work. And so how do you do that? Well, you start with what you have under control in your own life, because where else are you going to start? You look to yourself, put your house in order. Don't be worried about some other person walking the satanic path. And that's what activists do all the time, right? It's you. It's the corporations. Like, it's someone else. No, no. It's you. And I think that's also fundamental to the Judeo-Christian doctrine, is that it's you. It's on you. Redemption's an individual matter. And so my hope is that if enough people take themselves with enough seriousness, then we won't end up in hell. Because we certainly could. It's a high probability. And so, and I also don't think that you can be motivated enough to put your house in order to the degree that's necessary merely by being attracted, let's say, to the potential utopia that might emerge as a consequence of that. So that'd be a vision of heaven, let's say. No, you need to also be terrified of hell. Think, well, there's no such thing. It's like, just because you haven't been there doesn't mean there's no such thing. It's like, you have to be pretty bloody naive to think there's no such thing. Like, how much evidence do you need? And how does it come about? Well, it comes about at least in partial consequence of the sins of men. And I think that's true. So I go around and I talk to people. I say, look, there's not only more to you than you know, there's more to you than you can imagine. You have an ethical responsibility to act in that light. And you might claim not to believe that, but I would say, well, your whole culture is predicated on that belief. And insofar as you are an active member of that culture and a believer in its structure, then you believe it. You might not be very good at believing it. You might be full of conflict and doubt, and you might not be able to articulate it, but it's still right at the bedrock of your culture, this notion of what? The divine sovereign individual. Is that not what your culture is predicated on, that idea? The logos inherent in each person? It's something other than that? I've never seen a credible argument made to show that it's anything other than that. You know, you can say, well, rights are attributed to you by the state. It's like, sorry, that's a weak argument because the state's dependent on your actions. So, you know, to believe that, you have to believe that the state is the entity and that individuals are just subordinate in some fundamental sense to the state. It's like, no, the state is dependent on the individual to exactly the same degree. So we're the active agent of the state in some sense. We're the seeing eye of the state, the speaking mouth of the state, because the state's dead without the individuals that compose it.
C.S. Lewis, if I swallow the scientific cosmology as a whole, meaning only all that exists is what we can perceive through our senses, then not only can I not fit in religion, I cannot even fit in science. If minds are wholly dependent on brains, and brains on biochemistry, and biochemistry in the long run on the meaningless flux of the atoms, I cannot understand how the thought of minds should have any more significance than the sound of the wind in the trees. You feel that one as well.
Yeah, well, that's a complicated problem. That, first of all, I do believe that I don't think science is possible outside of an encompassing Judeo-Christian ethic. So, for example, I don't think you can be a scientist without believing as an axiom of faith that truth will set you free or that will set us free. So we don't know the conditions under which science is possible. And we tend to overestimate its epistemological potency. It's only been around, I mean, you can stretch it back to the Greeks if you're inclined, but in a formal sense, it's only been around for about 5 centuries, and it's only thrived for a very short period of time. And it's perfectly reasonable to assume that there were particular preconditions that made its rise and ascendancy possible.
It is a historical phenomenon.
Yes.
It happened at a specific moment in time.
Right, and for and at least so in principle for particular reasons. Yeah, and I think one of the conditions, well, there's a bunch of them. One is, for example, there's an intense insistence in the Christian tradition that the mind of God in some sense is knowable.
Yes.
So we could say, well, the structure of the cosmos, and you have to believe that that's the case before you're going to embark on a scientific endeavor. You have to believe that there's some relationship between logos, logic, let's say, but logos is a much broader concept than logic, that's for sure. You have to believe that there's some relationship between that and the structure of the cosmos. You have to believe that the pursuit of truth is in itself an ethical good, because why would you otherwise bother? You have to believe that there is such a thing as an ethical good. And those are not scientific questions, which is why I think the arguments of people like Hitchens are weak. It's like, yeah, Hitchens, Dawkins, people like that, they have a metaphysic which they don't know, and they assume that metaphysic is self-evident. It's like, well, sorry guys, it's actually not self-evident. And they assume that it can be derived from the observations of empirical reality. And the answer to that is, no, there's going to be axioms of your perceptual system that aren't derivable from the contents of your perceptual system. And you might think, well, that's not very scientific. And I would say, well, take it up with Roger Penrose and see what he thinks. Because I just talked to him for like 3 hours partly about this topic, about, say, the role of consciousness and the structure of consciousness. And it's by no means obvious that the materialist reductionists have the correct theory about the nature of consciousness. And not surprisingly, it's like we don't understand the relationship between consciousness and being at all. The conditions of human life are such that suffering is an integral part of existence. Life is suffering. Why? Well, one reason is because of society's arbitrary judgment. Every single one of us has traits and features and quirks and idiosyncrasies that are far from ideal and that are judged by the standards of society as insufficient. And so you suffer because of your imperfect insufficiency in the eyes of others. And you can certainly make the claim that fairly frequently that's arbitrary. And so that's the claim that
society is tyrannical and judgmental and needs to be constantly reconstituted so that the tyrannical element doesn't take full control. And fair enough, you have to stay awake so that that doesn't happen. But the thing is, it doesn't matter what society it is, although they vary in the degree of their tyranny. The mere fact that you're grouped together with other people and have to come up with a common value structure in order to live together means that many of the things that characterize you are going to be suboptimal. And so the price you pay for social being is that much of you is deemed insufficient. Now, hopefully there are various ways that you can be within a society that's sufficiently diverse so that you can find a place where what's good about you in the eyes of others and perhaps in your own eyes can flourish of its own accord. Because you don't have to be good at everything. If you can be good at one thing well enough, that might allow you your niche. And hopefully a healthy society allows for that. Certainly societies can become so tyrannical that they don't. The other element of it, clearly, is the mere fact of the arbitrariness of the natural world. You have a lifespan that's going to be counted in the number of decades that you can count on two hands. And that has nothing to do, technically, with the tyranny of the social structure. Now, you could say, if we got our act together more completely, perhaps you could live longer, and fair enough. But the fact of the limits of your lifespan and the suffering that's necessarily a consequence of that, the death of your parents and the death of most people that you will know before you, means that that part of suffering is an integral part of existence itself. And so that can't be laid at the feet of an insufficient social structure except insofar as it's tyrannical and blind. It's a condition of existence. And then by the same token, you have your own responsibility for some of your unnecessary suffering because there's things you could be doing to make your life better and to make life better for other people that you know perfectly well that you're not doing. So there's three reasons why you suffer, and one is, well, look at you and the way you're built. It's inevitable. There's not very much of you, and there's a lot of everything else. And so you just don't last that long, and you're fragile across multiple domains, and then you're harshly treated by society, and there's no doubt about that. And then there's responsibility that can be laid at your own feet. The proper pathway through that is to adopt the mode of authentic being. And that is something like refusing to participate in the lie, in deception and the lie, to orient your speech as much as you can towards the truth, and to take responsibility for your own life and perhaps also for the lives of other people. And there's something about that that's meaningful and responsible and noble, but also serves to mitigate the very suffering that produces, say, the nihilism or the flee into the arms of totalitarians to begin with. You need something to shelter you against your own vulnerability. And you can adopt a comprehensive description of reality that's formulated for you by someone else that neatly divides the world into those who are innocent and perhaps innocent victims and those who are guilty and perhaps the perpetrators of the suffering. But none of that has anything to do with you. And in addition, it's not a reasonable way of assessing the world. The suffering is built in. The existentialist take is, no, that's just how it is. That's just how it is. You don't have to necessarily have done anything wrong for things to get completely out of control. It's a terrifying doctrine, but it's not a hopeless doctrine because it still says that there's a way forward, there's a pathway forward, and the pathway forward is to adopt a mode of being that has some nobility so that you can tolerate yourself and perhaps even have some respect for yourself as someone who's capable of standing up in the face of that terrible vulnerability and suffering, and that the pathway forward, as far as the existentialists are concerned, is by, well, certainly by the avoidance of deceit, particularly in language, but also by the adoption of responsibility for the conditions of existence and some attempt on your part to actually rectify them. And the thing that's so interesting about that is, well, two, as far as I'm concerned, and some of this is from clinical experience, you know, if you take people and you expose them voluntarily to things that they are avoiding and are afraid of, you know, that they know they need to overcome in order to meet their goals, their self-defined goals, if you can teach people to stand up in the face of the things they're afraid of, they get stronger. And you don't know what the upper limits to that are, because you might ask yourself, like, If for 10 years, if you didn't avoid doing what you knew you needed to do, by your own definitions, right, within the value structure that you've created to the degree that you've done that, what would you be like? Well, you know, there are remarkable people who come into the world from time to time, and there are people who do find out over decades-long periods what they could be like if they were who they were, if they spoke their being forward. And they get stronger and stronger and stronger, and we don't know the limits to that. We do not know the limits to that. And so you could say, well, in part, perhaps the reason that you're suffering unbearably can be left at your feet, because you're not everything you could be, and you know it. And of course, that's a terrible thing to admit, and it's a terrible thing to consider, but there's real promise in it, right? Because it means that perhaps there's another way that you could look at the world, another way that you could act in the world, so what it would reflect back to you would be much better than what it reflects back to you now. And then the second part of that is, well, imagine that many people did that, because we've done a lot as human beings. We've done a lot of remarkable things. I often ask undergraduates how many hours a day you waste, or how many hours a week you waste, and the classic answer is something like 4 to 6 hours a day. You know, inefficient studying, watching things on YouTube that not only do you not want to watch, that you don't even care about, that make you feel horrible about watching after you're done, that's probably 4 hours right there. Now, you think, well, that's 20, 25 hours a week, it's 100 hours a month, that's 2.5 full work weeks, it's half a year of work weeks per year. And if your time is worth $20 an hour, which is a radical underestimate, it's probably more like 50 if you think about it in terms of deferred wages. If you're wasting 20 hours a week, you're wasting $50,000 a year. And you are doing that right now. And it's because you're young, wasting $50,000 a year is a way bigger catastrophe than it would be for me to waste it, because I'm not going to last nearly as long. And so if your life isn't everything it could be, you could ask yourself, well, what would happen if you just stopped wasting the opportunities that are in front of you?
Most people find deep meaning in their life as a consequence, not of their rights or their impulsive pleasures even, but as a consequence of bearing responsibility for themselves, for their family, for their community. And the heavier the responsibility, the better.
Well, Professor Stephen Hawking, before he died, gave me his last television interview, and he said that the biggest threat to the future of mankind was when artificial intelligence learned to self-design. What do you think the biggest threat to mankind is?
Narcissistic compassion. Now, AIs, you know, it's a threat too, but if we had our act together ethically, it's possible that AI could become a useful servant rather than a tyrannical master. You don't want to automate your tyrannical masters.
The ideal that you're observing that makes you jealous and resentful is in large part an illusion that's created by your own mind. You know, I can give you just one example. It's like, I know a fair number of extremely wealthy people, and I tell you, man, they have a burden of responsibility that would crush me, would crush the typical person. They're just working flat out, like 90 hours a week. You know, they have their money, and they have their status, and that's not nothing. But don't be thinking that there isn't a price to be paid for that. You know, they don't see their families, they're often divorced, they don't see their children grow up, and they don't have time off. Now, there are wealthy, what would you call, playboy types, I suppose, who live out the dreams of wealth of a foolish 14-year-old, but they're not that common, and you have to be careful of what you're jealous of, because you don't really know what it is. And then the other thing to understand, you're quite different from other people, and you shouldn't be comparing yourself to them, because they're not like you. You know, they don't have your family, they don't have your temperament, they don't have your troubles, they don't have your abilities. The only person that has those is you. Compare yourself to who you were yesterday and not to who someone else is today. And see, that's a game you can win, because you could be a little better today than you were yesterday.
Most of the time when you're discussing something that needs to be discussed, everybody's actually rather upset about it. You know, if you're actually talking right. about something sure. important, right? Because why talk otherwise, unless you're just shooting the breeze? But if there's an issue at hand that has to be discussed, then people are already upset and they have different viewpoints. And And the offensiveness, in some sense, is built into that. And you know that, because if you have a family, if you have a wife, if you have an intimate relationship, and you're discussing something that's difficult, the probability that you're not going to offend each other if you're actually having the conversation is zero. And so you don't have to think unless you have a problem. And if you have a problem, then when you think, you're going to offend people. And so what, are we not going to think? That seems like a bad idea. Liberals are higher in openness, that's trait creativity, and lower in conscientiousness, especially orderliness. And that seems to be because they believe, or their niche is an informational niche. They believe that the free flow of information is worth the risk. So that'd be the free flow of people across borders, the free flow of ideas across borders, the free flow of concepts across categories. They'd rather that the borders were permeable. Now, the conservatives are low in openness and high in conscientiousness, especially orderliness, and they take the opposite tack. They think, well, yeah, there's danger in too much openness. There's danger in borders that are too permeable. Things can change too fast. Entire societies can become destabilized, and everyone can end up not knowing which way is up. And the thing is that both of those attitudes are correct. It depends on the time. You know, sometimes things are changing so fast that everybody's knocked off their feet and things are falling apart. And sometimes things are so rigid that there isn't any new water flowing and everything's ground to a halt. You need liberals because now and then the right thing to do is to come up with something new. And you need conservatives because now and then the right thing to do is to do what everybody has always done. And the reason you need political dialogue is so that the liberals and the conservatives can continue to argue about which of those solutions is appropriate right now. The game of dividing human beings up by their group identity ends in disaster, no matter who plays it and no matter what the reasons are. Adopt a stance of ready engagement with the world and to reflect that in your posture. And the reason that I write about lobsters is because there's this idea that hierarchical structures are a sociological construct of the Western patriarchy. And that is so untrue that it's almost unbelievable. And I use the lobster as an example because the lobster, we divulged from lobsters in evolutionary history about 350 million years ago, common ancestor. And lobsters exist in hierarchies and they have a nervous system attuned to the hierarchy. And that nervous system runs on serotonin, just like our nervous systems do. And the nervous system of the lobster and of the human being is so similar that antidepressants work on lobsters. And it's part of my attempt to demonstrate that the idea of hierarchy has absolutely nothing to do with sociocultural construction, which it doesn't.